Simone Ferraro is going to be telling us about PSD. Simone was a PhD student at Princeton and is now a postdoc at Berkeley. He's around for the rest of the day, taking off in the morning.
Yeah, tomorrow morning.
And we're going to have a speaker dinner for him at 6:15.
All right. Hello, everyone. Thanks a lot for inviting me. It's always a great pleasure to visit PI, and a lot of collaboration here. So today I'm going to talk to you about kinetic Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. I'll explain briefly what it is and why I'm excited about it, and then talk about some recent measurements and the consequences of these measurements, both current and future. All right, and I have to say that a lot of this work is done in collaboration with many people, many great collaborators, one of whom is Kendrick Smith here. We chat a lot about these topics, and you know, so it's far from all this work being done by myself alone. All right, so a brief summary. I'm going to introduce, you know, what velocities are in the context of cosmology, why we care about them, and then give you some more motivation in trying to explain the missing baryon problem and how the kinetic Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect can help us address it. Then I'm going to talk about more like methods to go after it, show some recent measurements that I was involved with, and then discuss some new techniques for the future. All right. So let me just introduce briefly a bit of motivation. Why these kind of motivations are related, it will become clear very soon. But let me just say that when you observe present-day galaxies, there's something called the missing baryon problems, in a sense that we know the baryon abundance very well from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, from CMB observation, like ratio of peak heights in the CMB. And you also see most of the baryons in Lyman alpha forest at redshift above 2. But when you observe present-day galaxies, especially like either individual galaxies of group-sized halos, you see that you know, the baryon fraction, the measured baryon fraction here, is considerably less, like nearly an order of magnitude less than the cosmological abundance, which is up here. And this is a strong function of mass. So for the most massive clusters, it's not really a problem. So X-ray observations, the most massive clusters show essentially the cosmological abundance of baryons. But as you go down, say, Milky Way galaxies, like 200 rotational velocity of about 200 kilometers per second, you see that there's a big problem. And this is sort of summing up all the visible baryons. So the baryons are during stars that are probed by starlight, baryons that are like molecular hydrogen probed by CO, and various like 21 centimeter for atomic hydrogen, etc. And you add up all the observations, and you end up with a baryon deficit. So of course, we don't think that the baryons have some magically disappeared. We think there may be important feedback processes, probably from the central AGN of the galaxies, that blows the baryon out, you know, say outside the Viera radius. And so the baryons are thought to occupy, or at least one theory is that they occupy the outskirts of these galaxies and groups in a state known as the WIM, or warm-hot intergalactic medium. And this WIM essentially is too cold and too little density to be seen, say, in X-ray or through thermal Sunyaev-Zeldovich, but it will make up a considerable fraction of the mass in baryons of these galaxies. And in turn, you know, the distribution of this WIM will be very important to study processes of galaxy formation and AGN feedback. So this is one of the motivations. And then now I'm going to switch to something that, the last thing I should say, okay, this is astrophysics, but if you care about cosmology also, it's very important because baryons are 20% of the mass. So if you want to, say, measure neutrino masses through precision weak lensing measurement, well, weak lensing is affected by how the baryons are distributed, because you can't just take a dark matter simulation and come up with a weak lensing power spectrum, because again, when you aim for percent level precision, you have to take into account that 20% of the mass is not distributed in a trivial way or in a way that you would get from at least dark matter only simulations. When you include feedback is included usually through three parameters, and those three parameters is something that we wish to measure through the observations that we are doing now. So it also has very concrete cosmological applications, not only about astrophysics, not that there's anything wrong with the studying, you know, feedback, which is very interesting in my opinion. But the other topic that I'm going to address, and this just serves as an introduction, is velocities, because we'll see that KZ depends both on velocities and on the distribution of baryons. So I'm going to switch topic slightly and tell you about the brief velocity. So whenever I say velocity, of course, like in cosmology, we always mean peculiar velocity. So once the Hubble flow has been, the mean expansion has been taken out. Okay, so if you are stationary on a moving grid and this grid is expanding, you always say we have velocity zero. Okay, and then velocity is related to density by the continuity equation. Here, delta is the matter over density. And if you linearize this equation, you see that velocity in Fourier space is just directly proportional to the density, and the proportionality coefficient is this logarithmic growth factor, which in general relativity, it takes a very useful fitting function, is omega matter to the 0.55. This is really accurate for pretty much any cosmology in general relativity. If you have modified the theory of gravity, this dependence would be modified. So if we have a way to measure velocities, we have a way of probing the growth of density fluctuations, i.e. the theory of gravity. So in particular, this function is different. I plot it as a function of redshift, for example, for GR. If you have a higher dimensional theory such as DGP, this function is modified. That's all I want to say about this right now. The last thing I'm going to say about velocities is what do they look like? So of course, any velocity that you just put in the initial condition and is uncorrelated with density will decay as 1/scale factor. However, density perturbations grow, and with them, the peculiar velocities. So in matter domination, they scale roughly as the square root of the growth factor. So at high redshift, they are low, then they keep increasing up to redshift of about 0.5, where dark energy starts, the effect of dark energy starts becoming important, and then velocities stall, and they start decreasing, and in particular, if dark energy a cosmological constant, they'll always be decreasing from now on forever. But the take home message is that velocities are roughly constant in the, you know, at low redshift between 0 and 0.5, and the rough RMS velocity is 500 kilometers per second. This is the one number I would like you to keep in mind. And note this is 3D velocity, so for KZ, we only be interested in the line of sight component, so you get to divide this 500 by root 3, so get some RMS velocity of about 300 kilometers per second, or 10 to the minus 3, the speed of light. So that's the number that will be relevant for us. All right, so we are going to investigate both velocities and baryons using this technique, which involves the kinetic Sunyaev-Zadovich effect. So this is very simple. It's just a scattering of CMB photons of moving electrons. Moving electrons act like a mirror. If you scatter light or a black body off a moving mirror, you get a frequency shifted black body, or in other words, a black body at a different temperature. So the change in temperature due to this effect is essentially just the visibility function, this tau dotted to the minus tau, where tau is sort of Thomson scattering optical depth. So this just represents the probability of scattering at a given time, eta. Here, eta is conformal time. So you have the probability of scattering at a given time times the Doppler shift you have if you scatter that time. So it's really intuitive, okay? And this again, was predicted in the late 1960s. by Sunyer Zendovic and others, and it was only detected in 2012 because it's a tiny effect, it's a very subtle effect, okay? But now we have CMB experiments are good enough that we can actually measure it at reasonable statistical significance, and we can start doing physics and cosmology with it. So if we expand this formula, we see, first of all, that the total signal is not just proportional to velocity, but it's proportional to momentum, so the density-weighted velocity. And that's because it's proportional to the local density of electrons. And then it's also proportional by what fraction of the electrons are actually ionized, because only free electrons contribute to Thomson scattering. If all, at late times all the electrons were, saying stars or other neutral mediums, then we wouldn't have any kinetics to Sunyer-Zendovic. In particular, while we imagine that this F3 is at late redshift is more of order like probably around 0.9 or 0.85, and this is expected to be a function of redshift. One of the goals of precision KZ measurement is going after this number. Okay, and I'll remind you later that all our measurements will always be proportional to the fraction of free electrons. Okay. Another couple of things is that KZ preserves the black body spectrum of the CMB. So in particular, this is a curse because we can't use multi-frequency techniques to separate it. But also a lot of effort and time is spent on getting super clean CMB maps that look like a black body. So essentially, we get other foreground removals kind of for free. The last point is that it's so hard to detect because it's a tiny effect. Okay, for a 10^13 solar mass halo, okay, you get an effect which is 0.1 microkelvin. You should compare that to the RMS CMB fluctuations, which are 110 microkelvin. Okay, so you have this sub microkelvin fluctuation on top of 100 microK fluctuations in the CMB, It's proportional to mass. All right, so it's indeed very tiny and hard to extract, but I'm going to show you that we can actually do it. At the power spectrum level, I have to say that, so I told you that KZ is momentum, so it's 1 plus density times velocity. So there are two terms, there's the velocity term and there's the density times velocity term. The velocity term is always subdominant to primary CMB fluctuations, so it's very rarely important. However, this nonlinear term, and is intrinsically nonlinear, becomes much larger than the primary CMB fluctuations on very small scales, say at L bigger than 4,000 or so. Because of this property, we have some hope of, because of the scale dependence, we have some hope of detecting it, because it actually becomes much brighter. The fluctuations become much larger than the CMB on very small scales. Okay, and I should say that at the power spectrum level, there are two contributions. One comes from late times where density has gone nonlinear, so like redshift, half, where density is very nonlinear, so this term can be large. The other contribution, about the same size, comes from reionization, in which now the fluctuations are not really in density as such, but in ionization fraction. And indeed, during reionization, there are fluctuations in ionization fraction which are of order unity, so this term, again, can be nonlinear and can be large. So KZ is both interesting to study low redshift gases, also a very powerful probe of reionization, which is one of the sort of still very much open topics in cosmology. We know very little about it. Okay. So, but for the rest of the talk, I'm going to focus on the low redshift KZ. Where does it come from? Well, the point I want to make with this slide is, first of all, this is the contribution per redshift slice to the total KZ power spectrum at L of 3,000. The different curves are different models for star formation and AGN feedback. So you see that the amplitude depends quite a bit on the actual model that you put in the simulation. population. That's part of the reason why we would like to do these measurements and see, you know, which approximation works the best. But the other thing is that it's fairly, I want you to notice that it's fairly low redshift. So a lot of it comes from like redshift less than 2, the low time. So So now I'm going to go into the more, are there any questions on the sort of theory so far? Because I'm going to go more in the data mode from now on. Okay, so if there are no questions, I'm going.
Yeah. This isn't really a question. It's sort of intuitively surprising to me, I guess, that like half the signal, I look at the cumulative curves, like half the signal comes from redshift 3 or above. In the integral, it goes like one power of the growth factor is one power of the velocity growth factor over distance squared times d distance. I just thought it would be more suppressed than redshift.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Sure. Okay. Cool. So, any other theory question or comment? I don't know the answer. I mean, this is when you plot all the factors, that's what happens. I mean, even if you just forget about simulation, the dark matter only, which is the top curve, it is still true that you know, maybe 40% of the signal comes from redshift above 2. However, the redshift above 2 stuff is much harder to extract. So
he takes the question as a statement.
Yeah, I think it's a good statement. I don't have like a really intuitive answer for that, but yeah.
Okay. Are you plotting those parameters, or are you plotting
back the these solid curves are the derivative of CL with respect to redshifts. So the fractional contribution to the, and the dashed lines are the cumulative. Okay. So, for example, from the dashed line, if you say that the baryons trace the dark matter, you can say that 40% of the signal comes from redshift above 2, say. Okay, and then with some uncertainty on the exact models.
What's the difference between different lines?
Oh, it's different models of feedback and star formation. Yeah, so I would say there's still quite a bit of uncertainty on the theory, which is good because it makes the measurements like interesting and important, I would say. Okay. All right. Any other statements or questions? I'm averaging over. Sorry.
The L index.
Oh. Yes. Oh no! This is just a tell of 3,000. It's sort of close to where you get most of the signal to noise for this kind of.
My question related to Kendrick was whether there's significant L dependence in
this. Not in the region. Not in this region. L of 3,000 to say 5,000-6,000, which is where we get most of the constraints, then if you go to VeloL, yes, there is a significant, this curve changes, but there is where you are completely dominated by primary CMB fluctuations, and then, all right, so I'll start the data part by a non-detection, but a very interesting non-detection. Actually, this is one of my favorite Planck results. Planck papers is one of the intermediate papers in 2013, and they're still kind of being written. There are papers that claim that you can get rid of, you don't need dark energy if we happen to live very close to the center of a very large void. Okay, if we live in the center of a large void, then locally the universe is not homogeneous. Okay, so then you can find solutions to Einstein's equations that give you the right luminosity distance redshift relation, because because now Hubble parameter is a function of distance from us, even at a fixed time. And then you can explain, for example, the supernova data without any need for dark energy. Okay, it has to be kind of a coincidence because we have to be living really close to the center of this void, otherwise you would see a huge dipole. But if we did, then life would be very consistent, with most observations that are out there. But for that to be true, you need the sort of nearby clusters to be moving away very fast from us. So have some peculiar velocity of about 10 to the 4 kilometers per second to completely mimic the effect of dark energy. That would, of course, cause a huge KZ monopole because you'll see a cold spot in the CMB at the location of every cluster. And that's not seen in the Planck maps, which put very good tight constraint on the KZ monopole. And essentially disproves most void models for cosmic acceleration. Yep.
There are different void models.
Sorry?
Some of the models are simple, others are more complicated.
Yes.
For example, you have to put in pressure. The rate atomic bonding model doesn't have pressure. There are models where you put in radiation pressure.
Okay.
And also the Big Bang, if it's inhomogeneous, you can have a very late Big Bang. All these issues make differences.
Okay, so
the question is, which model are you talking about?
Oh, here I think simple. So you take void profiles from simulation and say we can live in a very large one. You look at the peculiar velocity of stuff on the edge. That's what you would get, etc. I know you can with the two modifications of gravity or making the universe very inhomogeneous early on. Then you can probably get away from these constraints. Yeah, but I think it's very nice. At least, if we are going to assume sort of standard cosmology, I think it's a very nice result still. But it doesn't say, of course, you can always cook up different theories of gravity or other things to get around most constraints. But that's life. I mean, if you given observation, if you work hard enough, there's always ways to get around it, I think. So I'm not claiming anything that completely disproves void models. Would you agree that it disproves the simplest void models?
Yeah, it's not definitive. It's not yet definitive.
Yeah, okay, just the simplest. Let's agree on that. Just the simplest, okay. And then you can do the same for the dipole and look for bug flows. And in particular, since you still have a subhorizon long wavelength modes of velocity, you expect some sort of dipole, but this is the RMS predicted, and they put pretty good bounds on that too. Let me talk about the first detection of KZ. This was in 2012, Nick and collaborators in the ACT collaboration. This uses a nice technique that essentially, I'm doing time, okay, great. This uses a nice technique that essentially says if you have a pair of galaxies, they are more likely to be falling towards each other than away to each other simply because of mutual gravitational attraction. Okay, so if I go in the CMB map and take the temperature at the position of the galaxies closest to me, and I subtract the temperature at the position of the galaxies further away, then I expect on average to get something negative, okay? And that's exactly what they say here, fairly good statistical significance. They get this negative result. At about the same time, slightly later, there are claims of detection of KZ also from individually merging clusters, but I talked about that last year here, so I'm not gonna repeat it here, and I'm just gonna go into how we do things right now. So essentially, you can think of this as, you know, we have some tracer population and we have CMB maps, okay? The simplest thing that you can think of doing is cross-correlating them because they both have information about tracer density. However, on small scales, if you just cross-correlate over density of traces with a CMB map, this is roughly zero because KSZ is equally likely to be positive or negative contribution. In other words, half of the galaxies will be moving towards us and half of the galaxies will be going away from us. So there will be a very large cancellation in any cross correlation of this kind because of this symmetry. Okay. So the next thing you can do, and that doesn't vanish, so to the lowest order that you doesn't vanish, is a cubic thing instead of a quadratic one. So where you put still one power of the tracers, one power of temperature, and now one power of velocity. This velocity essentially undoes this symmetry such that now instead of having cancellation, now you sum up the contributions, okay? And there are different ways to write down, these estimators, and one of the things Kendrick and I are working on is exactly making this connection clear. But you can think, if you have galaxy positions in 3D, I told you initially that you could just take the velocity is proportional to the 3D density, and the proportionality coefficient is just some kz over k squared for the radial velocity. You could do the pairwise sum, and you can show that sort of the pairwise sum is actually a close cousin of this estimator over here. I won't discuss the exact technical details, but you can think of the hand at all detection as using a very similar technique. Or if you have very good CMB maps, I mean, you know, high resolution, low noise, then the temperature map itself contains information about the velocity, because if you go in the temperature map and you have a big cluster that is coming towards you, you're more likely to see a hot spot than a cold spot. So, you know, the temperature itself just has also information about velocity, and I will say more about this later. So let me start by saying, suppose we have very good spectroscopic redshift, so we know the position of galaxies in 3D. Then this is really the thing we should do. So to get velocity, we invert continuity equation. And then you can think of all these analyses essentially building a guess for what the KZ signal will look like. So you take the observed density, you take the reconstructed velocity, and you integrate along the line of sight. That's your best guess at what the KZ field looks like. And then you cross-correlate the CMB temperature with this KZ field. And as a bonus, because of the symmetries, you get that foreground contamination is really highly suppressed because most foregrounds are uncorrelated with the velocity. So say, you know, thermal Sonnier-Zeldovich or dust, et cetera, they all have the same sign for each object, which means that now if you multiply this foreground by half terms with positive sign and half of them with negative sign, on average, they cancel out really well. So this allows us to do this analysis even when we don't have like multiple frequencies. So for example, in ACT, we only have one frequency channel, but we can still do this sort of analysis. Okay, so talking about reconstructed velocity, still a little more. So we use the two methods for doing the reconstructed velocity. One is the usual method that is used the Sloan Digital Sky Survey for doing baryonacoustic oscillation reconstruction. So that has been used for many years and is sort of well tested. And then we also use another method, which Kendrick has developed, which is actually actually the optimal method, the optimal linear reconstruction method in the case where you have linear theory. And it has a lot of advantages, and you should talk to Kendrick about it. It's really impressive work. It's one line in our paper, but it really could be a talk on its own on how you do this this velocity optimally. But anyway, here are velocities from Kendrick. So these are actually velocities, and positive means going up, moving away from us, and negative means moving towards us. And this is actually the Sloan DR11 footprint, and these are the real velocities during this reconstruction. Okay. The last thing I want you to notice, and it's kind of nice, so velocity in linear theory is a pure gradient, right? Which means that for a single mode, the variation of velocity is parallel to k, okay? So in particular, since we are only looking at the radial velocity, we would expect most of the variation to be along the line of sight. And indeed, this is, I don't know, this is a bit low resolution, but you see that this image is formed by many slices of different color because velocity decorrelates very fast along the line of sight, while it's very coherent on slices of constant redshift. And in particular, the variation, you can show that the variation of peculiar velocity is just a quadruple with the angle to the line of sight. Now we are only looking at the radial velocity. Okay, so then the radial velocity, whether the two points lie, you know, across the line of sight or along the line of sight is very different. Okay, so in particular, if the separation vectors lies parallel to the line of sight, so they are different redshifts, right? But along each other, then the correlation length is very short. So you have a lot of variation in the radial direction, and you have very little variation across. Okay, this is important if you want to design a survey to maximize the signal to noise, for example. You need to. So then when we do this with and test these reconstruction methods with simulation with sort of Kendrick's method, it gets a correlation coefficient between true and reconstructive velocity of about 0.7, and that means that due to the discreteness of tracers and the complicated mask of this Sloan survey, etc., we only lose about 30% in signal to noise compared to what it would be if we knew the velocities exactly. So it's really good. That's my point. There's a order unity. Let me take a brief just a couple of numbers to what you should expect or what you could expect to measure using this method. So if you have Planck plus 24,000 clusters, there are some forecasts by Ming Li and Simon White that says you should expect to get something like 7.7 on the Boss footprint. I'll be very interested to see a full analysis of clusters and combination with Planck. I know that some people are working on this. For us, if you have an experiment like Apollo SPT ball, you should get a signal to noise of roughly 6 every 500 square degrees patches. However, I have to say that these numbers depend a lot on the actual distribution of baryons in clusters, which I told you is very uncertain. So I'm going to go to the actual analysis now. So I'm going to talk about some work that I co-led together with Emmanuel Shan, and Kendrick was part of the analysis too. And this uses data from the ACTPOL telescope. So the ACTPOL telescope is a 6-meter CMB telescope in the Atacama Desert in Chile. We use a map of the ACTPOL telescope telescope at 150 gigahertz, so 146, and the area is 660 square degrees. The beam is really good, it's 1.4 arcminutes, it's very narrow for a CMB experiment. And the noise level right now is about 14 microk/min, even though now ACTBOL is being upgraded to advanced ACT, and that should lower, this should about half the map noise. And we are going to use it in we are going to use it in conjunction with BOSS DR11 galaxies, and we choose the CMAS sample, which is the higher. Is the higher redshift sample. It lies between redshift 0.4 and 0.7. And it's made up of objects with a mean mass of about 2 times 10 to the 13 solar masses. Oh, initially they wanted to form a roughly constant mass sample, okay? So I don't remember in terms of magnitude what the criteria were, but they thought, and it actually turned out that there is actually a fairly big scattering mass, but that is
color selected?
Yeah, it's color selected. Yeah, it's color selected. Absolutely. Yeah. But then it's been. Yeah, these catalogs have been studied very well. So the mean mass from Lensing is about 2 to the 13, and about 85% of them are central galaxies, okay, which will be important later on. All right. So next, so what we are going to do is we are going to use the BOSS galaxies. We are going to form that velocity reconstructed field that. I showed you, and then we are going to go at the position of the galaxies in the CMB map and try to extract as best as we can what the temperature fluctuation is there. To do that, we use an aperture photometry filter, which is essentially saying, okay, at the galaxy position centered on the galaxy, you put a disk with the size theta disk, okay, and you take the mean temperature in that disk. And then to that, you subtract the mean temperature on a ring around it with the same area. So from now on, delta T will just indicate the output of this filter. Okay. So we ask, what's the noise when you put down these filters? Say there was no KSZ, and I just filtered random positions in the map. What do I get? Well, of course, I have big CMB fluctuations. So if my filter is large, say above 2 arcminutes in size, I'm dominated really by CMB fluctuations. And since CMB fluctuations are very red, there's a lot of power on large scales, then as I decrease the filter size, I decrease the noise from primary CMB fluctuations. And at some point, and this is, of course, very experiment dependent, the detector noise comes in and then makes things much worse again. And this really depends on the experiment. This is the numbers for our actual map. The optimal, the sort of lowest noise is around 2 arcminute filters for us. So these are the results we recently put out a paper. This was a work led by Emmanuel Shan at Princeton, a graduate student at Princeton. So what do we do? What do we plot here? Essentially, we take the filter aperture. For each galaxy, we have some proxy for its mass. So we know if we assume the cosmological abundance of baryon, we can guess, we can come at a prediction for its optical depth. So we know KSZ should give us a delta T that is just tau times velocity, you know, optical depth times the velocity. And now we have both, so we can compare the filter output to our prediction. And the proportionality coefficient, we call this alpha. Okay. So if we were seeing all the baryons, in a sense, alpha should be 1. So for large aperture, we see that what we get is alpha is consistent with 1, okay, which means with big error bars, I'm not making any strong claims, but which means that we see most of the baryons, okay, or all of them. For small aperture, what happens is that if your aperture is too small, now you only enclose a small fraction of the, if the aperture is closed, you only enclose a small fraction of the baryons, okay? So then you're going to get something that is close to zero. You know, at in the limit as the aperture goes to zero, this curve has to go to zero. Okay, but then how fast it rises from zero to say one is just a direct probe of the profile. In fact, it's just the baryon profile convolved with this filter function. Okay, so then this plot, apart from providing you know a 3.3 sigma detection of KSZ, it's really a direct measurement of you know not super high significance, but it's a direct measurement of yeah. Yep. This is corrected, yes, because the actual when you work out the math, the actual combination that enters that plot is this correlation coefficient. So correlation coefficient will lower or thing. Is actually when you plug in the estimator, the quantity of interest is R times sigma true over sigma reconstructed, and Wiener filter guarantees that this is one. So actually, the Wiener filter field is exactly the thing you should use in the analysis. But you're right. If you just take the velocities, they will be biased low because we have smoothed the field you know, during the reconstruction of the Wiener filter. Yeah. So the velocities themselves are biased low. But then when you work out the right factors in the estimators, you see this is the right thing that enters. So it is taken into account. If we were just doing, it's just because of, I can show you later the form of the estimator. If we were doing cross correlation, for example, you're right. We should be correcting by 1 over R. We would be biased low. Low by a factor of R. Okay. So if we were just taking template reconstructed across T, then that would be biased low, and then we would need to correct by 1 over R. But here, actually, from if you write down the minimum variance estimator for alpha from this formula, summing over all the objects, the quantity that will enter in there is this. Okay, and that's one because of the filter. We actually checked this numerically too, is not? But you can show, Kendrick has shown it analytically that this is what you expect, and also numerically is what we get. But yeah, it's a very good point. There's many things. If when you want to make strong astrophysical statements, there are many things that can bias you, and that's part of the reason why we don't really quote a number for, say, the optical depth of these clusters. But what my main point here is that the you know we expect alpha to be zero for very small theta, to be one or around one, and we can discuss much more if it should be one or a bit higher. But the rate at which it increases is just the profile, okay? So this is what's in the paper. But now you can start playing some game and say, well, what would this look like if the baryons trace the dark matter exactly? So if the baryons had an NFW profile, we know the mass of these galaxies, so we want this profile to say enclose the virial mass at the virial radius, okay? And then it would look like something like this, okay? You know, and this is assuming full ionization. So if you want, you know, you're allowed to lower this curve by, you know, 10-15%. However, you can see that in the inner parts, there's already we can see a pretty statistically significant the detection of deviation, and this hints at is not super significant right now, but what this hints at is that in the inner part, so I remind you, sorry, I forgot to say this is very important, the virial radius is about 1.5 arc minutes here. So remember, this is a virial radius, okay? And you see that inside the virial radius, it looks like really that the profile is much flatter. Zero here means flat profile, okay? So it's much flatter than what an NFW would be, which is very peaky, okay? oh, it goes to, why does it go above one, you say? Oh, because, so NFW is normalized such that it has one virial mass inside the virial radius, but you know that NFW has a lot of mass in the tail also. And in fact, you have to truncate it at some point because the overall, the total mass diverges. In an, sorry, okay, so how you truncate, right now we truncate it at 3 virial radii, I believe, but how you truncate it makes a little bit of difference over here. It makes absolutely no difference close to the center. So we are completely converged. The slope here is completely determined. It's not close to the center. In the outskirts, it does, yes. So I have plots for a bunch from like truncating from 1 to 20 virial radii. I can show you these plots later. The only change is around here. And around here, we don't worry too much because our error bars are huge. So we stay still that you know we are consistent, but we can't really claim that we see all the baryons in the outskirts, okay? Because our error bars here are huge. What we really want to do in the next measurements is really go after these points, and the only way to reduce these error bars is by having more area, because this is the regime where we are dominated by primary CMB fluctuations. So the only way to reduce these error bars is really having more objects, more area, and that's what we are going after. However, in the inner parts, we can really say, and you know, fairly good significance, that we see deviations from NFW. And this is, you know, again, probably, I mean, good guess, I guess, is the effect of AGN feedback that we are seeing here. And to make sure that our analysis is not biased, we really want to have smaller error bars here and really show robustly that we agree with the cosmological abundance at large aperture and we disagree at the small aperture. But at the very least, we can say that we see evidence for the missing baryon problem in the sense that the amount of baryons at the virial radius here is much less than what you would predict, which is in agreement with other observations, okay, X-ray and so on, okay. Then of course the game we have started to play, this is just like an FW, but then you can compare with results from simulations with feedback. And generally feedback is a free parameter or at least poorly constrained. And then you can see which simulations or which feedback models and amount of feedback, et cetera, agree better with the data. And that's very much a work in progress right now. And I think is very interesting. Okay, I think this is like one of the most important plots of the talk, so if you have questions on this, is a good time to ask. Okay, let me go on then. Yeah, sure. Yeah. They are very correlated. So these last two, say they are, these last two, they are 90% correlated. And they are, these first two are probably like 15-20% correlated. But that is all the statistical, in the paper, every quantity, statistical quantity that we compute is computed with the full covariance matrix. So in other, and also if you want to ask what's the statistical difference between NFW and these data points is 9 sigma, including the full covariance matrix, so including the correlation of the points. Now we don't want to make any, and we don't make strong statements in the plot, in the paper, because again, we need a bit more work on this, but every quantity is computed using full covariance matrix. Yep.
You can make some log profile for the gas cross correlation, that's maybe not an NFW, but something else is more extended, and then just play the game of adjusting the parameters of such a model so that it fits your curve.
Absolutely. That's exactly what we are doing, and you may not want to know what this curve that goes really well to the points of the profile is. It's actually a Gaussian profile, okay, where we have fixed the sigma equals the virial radius and the amplitude is a free parameter, okay. So well, but okay, so of course we are not making the claim clusters are Gaussian. It's just something that is very flat at the top, okay? While the NFW profile actually diverges at the top in density, right? So that's why you see a big difference in the inside of, yeah.
Can I push a little further?
Yeah, sure.
I asked about the correlation because the points are so correlated.
They are.
Given the amplitude of the central point of these 7 points.
This
point. One, the middle one.
Here. Okay.
The correlation is so strong that you could pretty much predict the location of every other blue point just on the basis of knowing where that first point is. Very good.
Yeah, so actually. We have, so remember the physical scale. So this is virial radius, and here is 2 virial radii. I would argue that we have fairly good shape information within 1.5 virial radius because these points are not so correlated, okay? And we have no information here. But that is really, again, to claim we've solved missing baryon problems, we really want to see that this is consistent with and we can't really say it right now, because this you can think of the last 3 points as one data point if you want, because they are so correlated. So we have no profile information here. The first 3 points, I would argue, they give you profile information.
Yeah, the missing baryon problem. No one really believes baryons are missing.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, I just say that if the baryons followed an NFW profile, okay, this is what we would look like. Modular normalization is probably 0.9 or 0.85 or whatever it is, okay, but of order unity. And then I think it's fair to say that I see a difference from the first 3 points. I think it's fair to say that I see a difference between them. And that's what I would call, say, missing baryon problem. In the sense, we see less than you would predict if you thought that baryons follow the dark matter within the virial radius system. All right, cool, thanks. Okay, any other questions? All right, if not, let me just go on and say that, the same similar sort of analysis has been done by the Planck team also. And here is a 2015 intermediate result paper. And really KSZ is a function of 2 dimensions. One is the aperture size or your filter size, and that's the dimensions we were exploring, say the cluster profile or something. And the other dimension is nobody tells me that I have to use the velocity at this point to predict the KSZ signal here. I can also use the velocity at some separation little r, some distance little r. And that essentially tells me about the velocity correlation function, okay? Which is what Planck looks at. So essentially, the amplitude of this curve is determined mostly by the astrophysics, while the shape of this curve, in general relativity, is completely determined if growth is scale independent and general relativity is correct. Then I would say that adding this dimension doesn't earn you anything in terms of constraining power. However, this is, I think, a very good probe of scale dependence of gravity, which could either be due to scale dependent growth, I should say, which could either be due to scale dependent theory of gravity, or it could be due, say, to massive relativistic particles like massive neutrinos, for example. And we know that. So right now, this dimension still doesn't give super good constraints compared to other methods. But one day it was probably, this is another thing about KZ that you can use, because this is a direct measurement, a very clean measurement, I would say, of the velocity correlation function. And then if there are any funny features there, then this is one way to see them. Okay, so I would say generally, you know, the KSZ is a function of really two variables. One is our filter radius, our filter size, which mostly informs you about the astrophysics, and the other is this distance, which mostly informs you about gravity or cosmology. Okay, yeah.
Which number?
Oh, is 17. 17. No, 30. Sorry, 37. Yeah, 37. Yeah, 37. 37. Yeah, yeah, 37. Yeah. Okay, but this is the archive number. It's called the evidence for unbound gas. Okay, sorry. Yeah. All right.
You find out that it contains, the shape of this curve contains cosmological information.
Yeah.
And the velocity correlation.
Yeah.
How would that compare to the cosmological information that's in the quadrupole of the two-point functions of the galaxies?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is 2D, right? This is 2D information. So in terms of raw number of modes, then I think it's probably less. But on the other hand, it's very different systematics, right? Here is really just the CMB temperature that tells you this velocity correlation function. So to me, this is like super clean compared to many effects that you have to consider, say, when you're doing. In terms of raw number of modes, I believe, like, say, something like redshift space distortion have more modes, right? I don't know. I mean, as you know, we have taken more the astrophysical point of view for now, and I think that gives you good constraints. But I think, you know, this is one thing to keep in mind, that there are really two orthogonal variables here that you can explore. All right. So let me skip, in interest of time, let me skip the systematics, even though we can discuss really at length on why. And let me just remind you, this is something I talked about. I was very excited last year, and I gave a whole talk on this. So I'm just going to spend like 3 minutes reminding you what it is. Saying that we can use temperature itself as a proxy for velocity, because temperature also has KZ in it. Okay, so I told you, you know, if you do this simple cross correlation, you get zero because of this symmetry of radial velocity, positive or negative radial velocity. So I told you you can introduce a variable that scales like velocity, which could either be the velocity reconstruction, but it could be the CMB temperature itself. Okay, the CMB temperature itself is an unbiased estimate of the cluster velocity. It's just a very noisy one on the scales of, say, Planck resolution. Okay, but this quantity is non-zero in presence of KZ. Okay, if you square the CMB temperature in real space and correlate with tracers, it's non-zero, and you're just using T as a proxy for velocity. It's just a super noisy proxy. Okay, but what that allows us is it allows us to use, for example, we don't need redshifts. Okay, here you really can use projected fields. So you can use much larger samples of galaxies, say, for example, WISE survey, and you can use like full sky Planck information. So you know, it has advantages and disadvantages, I put it that way. The thing is, it's very challenging, because now you really have to trust that the foreground rejection argument that I told you before doesn't work. So it means you really need a super clean CMB map, from very free of all foregrounds. And that's why it's taken us so long to do this, because we had to do a ton of null tests and try different component separation methods, etc. This is what you expect if you do that cross correlation. You have a signal that is the green curve that is proportional to KZ. And it scales like very high power of cosmology times the growth factor and the fraction of free electrons squared. And you have a huge Lensing bias because also Lensing changes, you know, your locally measured variance in a way that is correlated with your tracers, because those tracers are the ones that produce the Lensing of the CMB. Okay, so, and the Lensing is a huge signal. It's much bigger than it's much bigger than C you're looking for. Luckily, it's oscillatory, so you can quite well, even from the data itself, without using external prior, you can fit the two simultaneously and get fairly low.
How well can you predict?
You don't need to predict it because we are going to marginalize over it.
Do you know that uncertainty? So these are small scales where like feedback and like profiles of objects.
Yes. Yes.
So if I just marginalize.
I completely agree that the theoretical interpretation is harder. I can tell you though we have I can show you a bunch of plots. We have tested these curves like to much better than our error bars with ray tracing simulations. I'll show you the plot. It works to like really few percent.
And
on the blue curve. No, but it's the former, but it agrees with the theory like very well. We should discuss later. I can show you the results for SIMS. Anyway, so this is the sort of thing you get from real data, and then we let both the amplitude of the Lensing curve and the amplitude of the KZ curve be free parameters, and indeed once you do that. You remove a good test is that you really remove this oscillation once you subtract the best fit Lensing curve, and this is some of the constraints you get on the KZ amplitude with Planck. So the blue curve is marginalizing over the amplitude of the Lensing completely internally from the data. We are not using any external data set. If you use instead the unmarginalized, so you say you have some external prior and bias, so for example, from using Planck Lensing map, then you get the green curve. But in any case, you see some evidence that there's sort of three sigma level for KZ. I should say this is completely disjoint scale. So our L max here is 3,000, which at the Wise galaxy redshift corresponds to something like 10-ish megaparsecs. Okay, so here all of this signal comes on scale larger than 10 megaparsecs. While we are super in the outskirts, right, of the halos. Here, the biggest scale that we were probing were 2 megaparsecs. Okay. And from 0 to 2, and now all of the signal comes from above 10 megaparsecs. Okay.
Sorry, well, I don't understand that logic. How do you know it comes from?
Oh, I mean the L max, course. You don't actually see in Planck. You don't see individual halos which are arc minute in the sky. You have a T square, so you have some mode mixing, but because of the filter, which is peaked at L of 3000, you get most of the signal to noise comes from 2500, which corresponds to physical scales of about.
So you're filtering the Planck map?
Yes, we are filtering the Planck map with a match filter, which is proportional to the CLKZ over the CL total. So, like, primary plus noise plus KZ. And that peaks between 2500 and 3000. So you want to remove all the low L, CMB, primary CMB power, and you want to remove the very high L noise, right? And you just want to be in the where the KZ is biggest compared to the noise, right? That is scales between like 20 and 5 probably megaparsecs in our filter that you get in our filter. Yeah. So, but anyway, the point I wanted to make is that it's different scales we are probing here. Okay, we are much further away because simply the Planck beam smooths out all these clusters on the sky, right? So, all right. So okay. Yes, it's huge issue. Yes, so that's why it took us a year to do all the null tests we wanted to do. Yes, yeah. There's a huge. So this is like a crazy idea, okay? There are huge possible systematics. One is Lansing, CIB, you know, dust. Not really CIB because mostly uncorrelated, but it's the dust emission from these low redshift galaxies or the galaxies correlated with them that. That is most important. But yeah, we spent a year doing null tests, and now I think we have something that we are reasonably happy with. Of course, you know, better maps, better component separation techniques will help us a lot on this. Okay, the point I want to make is that Planck is really not the right experiment to do this, okay? Because here, you know, here's the Lmax of Planck, and here is the correlation coefficient between the CMB field and the total field, so KZ plus CMB. The correlation coefficient KZ only and KZ plus primary CMB, okay? So it's super low at all the Planck Ls accessible by Planck. So which means that what we are doing is taking essentially noise and squaring it with a tiny bit of signal. Okay, so it's really suboptimal. It's super suboptimal for Planck resolution. But as you go to higher and higher L, the temperature map filtered on those scales become more and more a tracer of the KZ field, okay? And that's all I want to say. It's really just very suboptimal for Planck. It's just a proof of concept that you can do something like that. You can use temperature information in the CMB map as a proxy for KZ itself, and that's all I want to say. So let me just conclude that you know, we are just at the beginning of KZ measurements. There's a lot of scope for both astrophysical and cosmological measurements. You know, CMB experiments are getting better and better. Large scale structure surveys are also getting better and better really fast. So with that, I just want to thank my fantastic collaborators and thank you all for your attention. All right. Any more questions?
This so you had the signature as a slide. So are you going to do this with ACTBOL as well, the same analysis?
With advanced ACT, we might try, yes, because we have five frequencies. You really need very good frequency information, and then it really depends up to which L you can clean effectively. Okay. Yeah. And,
so the ACTBOL, you're not
going to
do it?
Oh, with the ACTBOL alone, no, not with the current data, but advanced ACT is taking data in a month. And then there, I think we'll probably look at that. And then it really depends on you know, how well we pass null tests, whether we trust what comes out or not. Okay.
So this new method, the second method you mentioned also is 3-sigma. That's what you require.
But on a much larger, on a full sky with Planck and WISE, so we are using 100 million galaxies rather than 30,000. So the signal to noise per object is much, much, much less, right?
Yeah.
Because it's a ridiculous method to use with Planck. It's just we wanted to show that you can do it. You know, you can use T as a, you know, as having some information. Of course, the optimal thing to do if you are, well, the point with WISE, you can't really use the traditional techniques because you don't have redshifts, okay? So you're stuck. You can't do anything if you don't. You don't know the 3D position of WISE galaxies well and within a correlation length of the velocity, okay? So, in other words, you know, they are out there. There are these huge, huge catalogs which normally you wouldn't be able to use. And using these techniques, I'm not even claiming it's optimal in using T, etc. You can do better, but you know, there is a way to also use these huge, huge photometric catalogs to do KZ and to harvest further, like you know, additional information if you want. If you have a catalog which has, you know, photometric redshifts which are, not so good but still not terrible, then the optimal thing would be a combination of the two, you know, some minimum variance combination of the two methods.
Sorry, a very naive question. Sure.
Oh, so what we are doing in practice is you can use this formula to get from density you go to radial velocity, okay?
Yeah, I want to ask where did you get the density?
So the density is just number over density of the Sloan survey. So you have a galaxy catalog, you just look what's delta n over n locally, that's your delta times bias. So we just assume that on the scales where you do the velocity reconstruction that the galaxy over density and the total matter are related by a linear bias model. However, I also have to say that the KZ itself is only produced by the bias, is only produced by variance, right? So.
Yeah. And another question is that the KZ signal has no redshift. Right. That you are feeding like velocity of certain redshift to the signal of the whole redshift.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. So let's see. Are you asking like?
Yeah.
Okay. So here we go on individual galaxies, right? And we take the temperature, the map at the location of the galaxy. For that galaxy, we know the redshift. Okay, and we know its reconstructive velocity. And Kendrick's code for reconstructing velocity knows about the redshift dependence of all the cosmological factors that go in there. So what you can be worried about is other galaxies that happen to fall in the same filter, you know? And that's what we call a two-halo term. And we can show that it's unimportant for aperture less than 3.5 or 4 arc minutes, but then it becomes very important out here. And then you get crosstalk between different redshifts and all sorts of. Yeah.
If you go back to the previous slide with the, velocity in Fourier space.
Oh, yeah.
I can just ask you the question. Have you looked at, I'm just curious, which wavelengths or which modes actually dominate the signal in your particular sample?
Right. The RMS, so what enters the KZ power spectrum is RMS velocity. And the RMS velocity, I believe, is still has redder power spectrum compared to density because of the one, okay. But I think it's still true that most of the, or at least in a logarithmic sense, most of the contribution to the RMS velocity still comes from around k equality. So like if you plot k cubed times PVV, I still think it peaks at k equality. I have to check that, but I believe it's true. This is an easy check we can do. There's very small scales are filtered out because, we have, we have a shot noise, so the Wiener filter will automatically smooth out the scale such that you are sample variance limited on all scales.
Questions for Smollett? Let's speak.